Today is Friday, March 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up...
Algeria is always seen as the gateway from Africa to Europe. Europe has always looked on Algeria as being the country that would be able to, first of all, stop or try and stop illegal migration.
That's reporter Catherine Field in Paris. Europe's leaders nervously watch more protests today in Algeria. Also ahead, the UN Commission of Inquiry on Syria finds violations and lawlessness remain widespread throughout the country. It's all on today's International Edition. An Indian Air Force pilot shot down over Pakistani-controlled Kashmir crossed the border back into India just over an hour ago, greeted by Indian military and government officials. Wing Commander Abdhinandan Vardhaman had been shot down Wednesday over the disputed region of Kashmir. Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan told lawmakers yesterday that the pilot would be released as a peace gesture. People waited for hours on the Indian side of the border today for the pilot's arrival. Both countries claimed to have shot down warplanes of the other on Wednesday as tensions increased following a deadly car bombing in Indian-controlled Kashmir that killed at least 40 members of the Indian security forces. The incident quickly elevated tensions between the nuclear-armed neighbors to a level not seen in well over a decade. The U.S., China, and other countries have called for calm between the South Asian governments. Well, U.S. President Donald Trump says his relationship with North Korea's Kim Jong-un is very good, despite the collapse of the two leaders' summit in Vietnam. Today on Twitter, Trump said the two had very substantive negotiations. He did not address the pushback from North Korea, which disputed his account of why the summit fell apart. Sagar Magani with the Associated Press in Washington has more.
The president tweets, "We know what they want, and they know what we must have." But he's not addressing who said what. This was the president yesterday on why the summit broke down.
Basically, they wanted the sanctions lifted in their entirety.
North Korean officials say that's not true. They want partial sanctions relief. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is backing the president's account that the North wants full relief.
That's true. They basically did ask for that.
It seems the North is telling the truth. A senior U.S. official says it wants the lifting of sanctions imposed the past 3 years that hurt civilians, not earlier ones directly tied to nuclear and missile technology. Sagar Magani, Washington.
As the Algerian government braces for more demonstrations today over President Abdelaziz Bouteflika's plan to seek a fifth term in April's elections, European leaders, especially France, Italy, and Spain, are watching with alarm. While they have great interest in Algeria's stability, they have little influence over its political class. On immigration, the Europeans need Algerian authorities to head off potential illegal migrants before they can get on boats to cross the Mediterranean. Algeria also makes significant contributions to European counterterrorism efforts. I spoke with reporter Catherine Field in Paris about Europe's concern and possible actions over the protests.
Algeria is always seen as the gateway from Africa to Europe. Europe has always looked on Algeria as being the country that would be able to, first of all, stop or try and stop illegal migration. Now, that illegal migration is those coming up through West Africa into Algeria, across the desert, and getting on to boats, life rafts, whatever, in the Mediterranean. So they've been relying on Algeria to do that. Again, also terrorism. Algeria is a key player for the European Union when it comes to dealing with groups such as Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb. To that end, the European Union has got enormous number of security operations, workings with the Algerian security forces to try and make sure that if those groups are not put to bed, then they're at least pushed back and can no longer threaten Europe. Also, the EU is very active in Algeria when it comes to de-radicalization. A lot of the terror attacks that have gone on in Europe really in the last 20 years have involved young Algerians who have slipped into Europe, who have been radicalized, who have got involved in this type of radicalization of young Europeans who are actually carrying out terror attacks. So they are particularly concerned about that. On top of that, Algeria is a very large trading partner for the EU. The EU gets about a third of its natural gas from Algeria, so it's very important for their economy. So you could really say that all round, it's just every single aspect of what keeps Europe safe has a big question mark over it when they look at Algeria.
Because of President Abdelaziz Bouteflika's plan to seek a fifth term, you know, this is what is causing a lot of this uprising and protest. So what is President Emmanuel Macron, what is his relationship with the president of Algeria and what are his concerns?
His main concerns really are transparency. The relationship between France and Algeria is very scratchy. France used to be the colonial power. There's still this very raw emotions about how France acted in the years up to Algerian independence. So France has got a very difficult relationship because it can't be seen in any way to interfere with the goings-on in Algeria. That having been said, Emmanuel Macron did visit Algeria in 2017. He has gone to a lot of effort to make job openings and youth training possibilities for young Algerians in France to happen. But what they're trying to do is just say, not look as though they're getting involved, but to keep pushing along these lines to saying, everything needs to be open, needs to be on the table, there needs to be a free press, there needs to be transparency in the whole electoral process. But of course, Bouteflika spent a long time in France in the last couple of years receiving medical treatment here. So the ties between the French military and the Algerian military are still very strong.
And he even apologized for French atrocities during the Algerian War of Independence when he was in Algiers. What does this really say about him?
First of all, let's not forget, he came in for a lot of criticism here in France for saying that. He was really going out on a limb. There are a lot of people who had memories of Algeria that did not like the idea of a French president apologizing. What Emmanuel Macron really wants is he wants Algeria to succeed, and he sees it having the real problems that a lot of the other North African countries do, which is this high rate of youth unemployment. So that's what he's aiming at. In fact, you could almost say this is the Emmanuel Macron doctrine, that he's been not just to Algeria and to North Africa, but also into the Sahel, that unless you start looking at making jobs available for these young people and also having a higher participation rate of women in the workforce, then you're still not going to be dealing with the actual root causes of some of this uncertainty and the radicalization that's happening with the young people in these societies.
And just looking at these demonstrations that are taking place, observers are finding that there really is no obvious leader. They were organized on social media anonymously. So what is the government's reaction to this, and will they use violence to try to stop it?
This is the big fear, that the regime in Algeria will resort to violence because they really do have this very strong hold on power, and they are pretty much keeping with the same message that Algeria's peace, its relative tranquility, its economic prosperity is thanks to this clique that has the power there. So until such time as there is more of a civil society growing up in Algeria, there will be this continual fear that there will be a crackdown, as we've seen crackdowns in the past in Algeria.
This is Science in a Minute.
Back in January 2016, astronomers Constantine Batygin and Mike Brown at the California Institute of Technology generated a lot of excitement when they said they found evidence of a giant planet they called Planet Nine in the far reaches of the solar system. Now, 3 years later, the two scientists and their team of researchers have published two new studies that provides new details about the suspected nature and location of the giant mystery planet. The first paper, published back in January 2019 in the Astronomical Journal, suggests clustering of objects in the Kuiper Belt, a collection of various icy bodies beyond Neptune, is affected by a so far unseen planet such as Planet Nine. The second paper, published recently in the journal Physics Reports, provides fresh insight into the characteristics of Planet 9 that include it being smaller and that it's closer to the sun than thought. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Among the top stories in the world, Bangladesh tells the United Nations Security Council that it cannot take any more Rohingya refugees. Cambodian union leaders say Prime Minister Hun Sen's promise of additional benefits to vulnerable women, including garment factory workers, comes after the EU threatened to withdraw from a key trade deal with Phnom Penh. And the Red Cross says the rates of malnutrition and disease in Pakistan's drought-affected regions are alarmingly high. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition. In its latest report, the UN Commission of Inquiry on Syria finds rights violations and lawlessness remain widespread throughout Syria, despite a general winding down of the war as pro-government forces make military gains. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The UN Commission finds a significant drop in fighting in Syria during the reporting period from mid-July 2018 to mid-January 2019. That, it says, is mainly due to extensive military gains made by forces allied with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and an agreement between Turkey and Russia to establish a demilitarized zone in the northwestern part of the country. But UN investigators say the war is not over. Hostilities continue. They say attacks by pro-government forces in Idlib and western Aleppo have caused scores of civilian casualties. They say civilians also suffered from the fighting by Syrian Democratic Forces and the U.S.-led International Coalition Against Islamic State Militants in Deir ez-Zor. Chair of the UN Commission, Paulo Pinheiro, says the Commission does not evaluate the decisions made by any member state engaged in Syria. But he tells VOA the Commission is deeply concerned about the possible implications of any large-scale troop withdrawals. He says they could deepen insecurity and have a harmful impact on the rule of law and human rights.
The withdrawal of U.S. troops from northern Syria or from those at Al-Tanf zone in south near Rukban, indeed have the potential to deepen, and I repeat, security vacuums, and in the north to increase tensions between Kurdish and Turkish forces.
A U.S. military base in the Al-Tanf zone in Rukban, a Syrian desert outpost near Jordan, is sheltering thousands of displaced civilians. Washington has said it would withdraw 2,000 U.S. troops from eastern Syria near the Turkish border since IS militants had been defeated. But it has since decided to keep 500 troops in the predominantly Kurdish-controlled area. Though the war appears to be winding down, the Commission says it is unsafe for millions of internally displaced people and refugees to return to their homes of origin in Syria. Before sustainable returns are feasible, it says there must be a substantial and permanent reduction of hostilities. The three-member Commission says all warring parties must guarantee returnees will not face persecution, discrimination, arbitrary detention, and torture. It says only tangible progress toward a political settlement ending the 8-year-old conflict will make that possible. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The sounds of gun battle continue to rock Somalia's capital today, a day after two car bomb attacks by insurgents were launched on one of Mogadishu's busiest streets. Officials say at least 20 people have been killed and 40 wounded in the bombings and the clashes between the militants and security forces. Al-Shabaab, the Al-Qaeda-linked terrorist group, has claimed responsibility. Well, Israel's attorney general has recommended that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu be indicted in three separate corruption cases. Linda Granstein reports from Jerusalem.
After 2 years of investigations, Israel's attorney general recommended that the prime minister be charged with bribery in one case and breach of trust in two others, subject to a hearing. Netanyahu hit back hard at the attorney general and what he called the leftist media, accusing them of trying to make sure he loses the upcoming election. He said that he is 4,000% sure that all of the accusations against him will be proved false and that he will continue to be prime minister for many years to come. Earlier, before his announcement, Netanyahu got a boost from President Donald Trump.
I can say this, that he's done a great job as prime minister. He's tough, he's smart, he's strong. He is very defensive. His military has been built up a lot.
The Attorney General's recommendation for indictment comes 39 days before Israel's election and could swing support away from Netanyahu and his Likud party. A new centrist party, including three former army chiefs of staff, is gaining ground. Netanyahu insists that he will not step down unless he is convicted. Even a final decision on indicting him after the hearing could take months. At the same time, the Attorney General said he was dropping charges against Netanyahu's wife, Sarah, in a separate investigation. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
This is VOA's International Edition.
Hello, I'm Linor Moudou, host of Health Chat. Tuesday on Health Chat, we will discuss rare diseases, a group of disorders that affect about 350 million people around the world and are difficult to diagnose. Our guest is Chika Dunyo, Director of Education Programs with the U.S. National Organization for Rare Disorders. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The U.S. country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. Health Chat, this Tuesday at 1730 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
This is VOA's International Edition. Well, two Saudi Arabian sisters hiding in Hong Kong after fleeing what they say is certain retribution at home for renouncing Islam are in immigration limbo after their permission to stay in the autonomous Chinese city expired yesterday before they were granted political asylum. Known as Rawan and Reem, false names used to protect their identities, the sisters have been in Hong Kong for 5 months since they fled a family vacation in Sri Lanka. Their lawyer, Michael Vidler, says the sisters, age 18 and 20, could face the death penalty for the crime of renouncing Islam if they return home. As Hong Kong has not signed the 1951 United Nations Refugee Convention, Rawan and Reem have applied for asylum in an unknown third country. Saudi Arabia, however, canceled their passports in November, and the women now face an uncertain future as tolerated overstayers, Vidler says. Well, scientists say we must drastically cut meat consumption to fight climate change and sustainability, feed a human population set to reach 10 billion by 2050. Getting from rhetoric to reality, well, it's not easy. But from Paris, Lisa Bryant reports on a growing effort afoot to champion green cuisine that is getting chefs, scientists, and analysts all on board.
Spelt risotto was on the menu at a recent lunch in Paris, featuring ingredients not usually found on our dinner tables. Spelt is an ancient form of wheat with a nutty flavor. It's also rich in fiber and minerals and counts among dozens of sometimes ancient and obscure foods we need to start eating, scientists say, for ourselves and for our planet.
75% of our foods come from 12 crops and 5 animals. 75% of everything we eat. 60% of all of our calories come from just 3 vegetable crops.
David Edwards is Director of Food Strategy at environmental group WWF, which jointly produced a report, Future 50 Foods, with German food giant Knorr. The message, our current eating habits, relying on large-scale farming and livestock production, have got to change.
We have 60% decline in wildlife populations since 1970, the last 50 years, within a lifetime. Now we've just heard, I mean, you may have seen the news, a precipitous decline in insect populations also. The food system has pushed wildlife to the extreme margins.
The Paris lunch featured many of the report's so-called future foods. Vegetables are in, meat is out. On the menu, walnuts, root vegetables, lentil flour, yams, and soy milk. Also, fonio, a drought-resistant grain that Senegalese chef Pierre Thiam now markets in the United States and serves at his New York City restaurant, sourcing it from smallholder farmers in Africa.
We're still importing food like rice, for instance, in Senegal. And yet we could have our own fonio, our own millet, but we still have that mentality of what comes from the West is best.
So today, we're all really blessed.
Former White House chef Sam Kass, who led Michelle Obama's campaign against childhood obesity, is now fighting for the environment.
When we talk about these dramatic changes that we need to overhaul everything, people are like, I don't know what you're talking about. Like, I don't know what to do. So we have to really get it down to, like, what is it you can do? And here it's like, just pick two or three foods and eat them once a week. That would be a big start.
Here in Europe, research fellow Laura Wellesley of British think tank Chatham House says governments need to better respond to a dietary shift to so-called plant-based meat and, more controversially, meat grown in laboratories.
The EU has really invested quite heavily in this area, but it could do more. It could invest more public finance in the research and development of cultured meat and plant-based meat options that are truly sustainable and are healthy options. And it could also support the commercialization of innovations.
At the Paris lunch, diner Thomas Blom gave his first course a thumbs up.
Some sort of a soup with a lot of spices and some new ingredients, so it was really interesting to see. It tasted really well with lentils.
Diners feeling a bit sleepy after the 7-course tasting menu could always try the green moringa after-party booster juice before heading back to work. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Thank you, Lisa. Well, it is a pioneering camera that has been inspired by human biology and can track objects in space in real time, even during the day. The world's first technology has been developed in Australia and will be officially unveiled at an international air show this week. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The device, called the AstroSight, is designed to help prevent satellites located beyond the Earth's atmosphere from crashing into each other. It's been developed at the Western Sydney University's International Centre for Neuromorphic Systems. It combines the disciplines of electrical engineering, computer science, signal processing, and neuroscience. The project has the support of the Australian military. The device can track objects in space in real time. Academics say it functions like the human eye and brain to produce high-resolution images even during hours of daylight. Associate Professor Greg Cohen.
It's modelled off the human eye, the actual photoreceptors in the retina, and the way they send information out, because they don't take frames, they don't take pictures. They send out just changes. It's really hard to track objects in space. There's a lot of space junk up there, there's a lot of satellites up there already, and we're launching more and more every day. So it's become a matter of national and international importance to make sure that things don't collide. And because you can move the sensor, there's no reason why we couldn't do this from an aircraft, or from a ship, or from a train.
Researchers say that with tens of thousands of man-made objects orbiting in space, the risk of collision between debris, satellites, and spacecraft is significant. This has ramifications for commercial organizations, but also for national and international defense agencies. Military officials in Australia say the device is a game changer because of its ability to see into space during the day and its mobility. The AstroSight was developed with the Royal Australian Air Force as part of Plan Jericho, a long-term strategy to make it one of the most technologically advanced air forces in the world. It'll be demonstrated for the first time in public at this week's Avalon Air Show in the Australian state of Victoria. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
You've been listening to International Edition, and you can find us at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, and our engineer, Nick Ivanoff. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.